I never take the moment in because I'm always thinking about the next thing, you know? Yeah, yeah. Even when I played music, I could be on stage with people singing lyrics back to me and with the band, and the band's up there having a party, thinking about the drink they're going to have afterwards. And I'm up there thinking, okay, how are the lights working? What's our next show? You know, I just can't stop that way and take it in, man. So,
well, you know. You need to take it in, bro, because we're about to have some fun. We're about to have some fun. What up, what up, what up? Hey, everybody. Yo. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. What's up? It is such a treat to have you guys back in the house for another great conversation. So as you probably already heard, I'm so stoked for this. And this has been, this moment has been, what, 3-4 months in the waiting for this to arrive. And it finally has, where I have a chance to sit down, and I'm going to break all kinds of protocol and just call this brother a friend, even though we have physically never met face to face. We've had text messages, we've had phone calls, and now we've got a little Zoom thing going on. But because of what he's written and the way he wrote it, I saw so much of myself in his story that I'm like, okay. I didn't even see you in the room when this happened in my life. Where were you, in the corner? His name is Tyler Merritt. You know him. I know you know him. He's an actor, musician, a comedian, an activist behind the Tyler Merritt Project. He was raised in Las Vegas, and and that in the book alone is just how he talks about growing up in Las Vegas. He's always brought this passion that he has for laughter, grace, love, and love for him is a little bit of a hiccup. We'll get into that. Right? Am I right or am I right?
You are not wrong.
Okay, here we go. Right. For over 20 years, Tyler has spoken to audiences ranging from elementary school students to nursing home seniors. His television credits include ABC's Kevin Probably Saves the World, Netflix Messiah, which I that Messiah piece, that thing is the joint. People, just don't sell yourself short on Netflix Messiah, people. Don't do it.
Got cut after one season, but what do you do?
Oh my God, they're not doing a second season?
No. We'll talk about that.
Oh, that sucks. All right, anyway. Okay. Netflix's Outer Banks, Disney Marvel's Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and Apple TV's upcoming series Swagger. His viral video, and this is where you know this brother from, Before You Call the Cops and Walking While Black. Those videos set the tone in many respects, because they've been viewed by 60 million people. About the powerful insight into our politics right now and how race and the complexities of race kind of play into that. He's a cancer survivor who lives in Nashville, Tennessee. I don't know how a brother winds up living in Nashville, but he is, so he's there. Tyler Merritt, welcome to the podcast, baby.
Yo, man, let me just tell you, first and foremost, Michael Steele, man, for any of the people that are watching this that may have never listened to your podcast that are familiar with me, I just have to say from the get, man, I will never forget when I sent you the book and I was actually on a meeting with my publisher,
right,
on a meeting, and I looked down at my phone and there's a text message that says, "Brother, rake the dirt," and then you called me, and I'm on a meeting and I'm like, "Yo, Michael Steele's calling me," and they're like, "Well, pick it up." And so I picked it up, and I was like, but man, I'll tell you why I freaked out, because I've been watching you for years, man. And let me just say, on behalf of, I'm sure, many people around the world, but specifically from a Black brother, to watch you take the stance that you've had in this political season, and I open up my dedication of the book by saying, we are not monolithic as Black people. We are not monolithic. And our stories are so not typical, but the fact that you tell such a story and stand your ground. Yeah. And even in the previous administration, you stepping up and using your voice the way that you did, people don't understand how that stuff cost us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They don't understand the cost of those things. So I just want to say thank you, bro, for
I appreciate that.
Who you are.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. And, I think that's why I connect so much to the book, because you walk through a lot of that reality, that truth. Things have a cost to them, whether it's in love, whether it's in business, whether it's in just getting up in the morning and putting on your pants and your shoes.
Right.
There are costs that come with that you're willing to pay. And which is why I love it. So people are sitting there going, well, what book do you love so much? Because you haven't told us what the book is. Well, I'm going to tell you what the book is. The book is, the title alone tells you everything you need to know. I Take My Coffee Black. That's the book, baby. I Take My Coffee Black. And it is an incredible story, because as you say on the cover, it's a reflection on Tupac, music, musical theater, faith, and being Black in America. And in so many ways, you step into your own narrative the way a lot of people don't. How did you make up your mind to do that? Because before we get into some of the elements, because the book is hysterical. When he starts talking about his mama, you know, Black girl magic, Black mom magic. I mean, it's just all of these little pieces, but it takes a lot before you can begin to share those sides of your story. How did you come to the point, particularly after the success of your other works, that did go viral, when you know, before you call the cops, which is probably the one that just people just like in their face. That was, but that was a moment. He was like, okay, I just put this piece out there and see what happens. This book is, okay, here's the rest of the journey.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you this, man. I decided from the very beginning that if I was going to write a book, it wasn't going to be, because I had a couple of publishers reach out to me that were kind of Christian publishers.
Right.
And I didn't even pay any of them attention, to be really honest with you, because I did not want to just put out a book for book's sake. I didn't want to just write something that was like a, hey, let me encourage you guys and follow. I decided that if I was going to write a book, Michael, that it was going to be an experiment in proximity. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, if I can invite you, no matter who you are in the world, to walk close with me, but not just like, kind of get to know me a little bit. I'm talking really close, and let you into my failures, to let you into my shortcomings, to let you into my personal issues where I was broken and put back together again. I talk about in the book that now that I'm in my 40s, I'm much less interested in how you killed it or how you were Stone Cold Player at something. I am much more interested in your failures, because they tell me who you are and how you got through them. And so, man, I'll be honest with you. There were many moments when I was writing this book where I broke down in tears, thinking like, do I even want to live through some of these things again? But for the sake of proximity, if I can write it and then you find yourself in my stories, or you go, yo, I almost feel uncomfortable. I'm like a fly on the wall watching this brother walk through this stuff. But in it though, I think it allows us to connect. And so, that was really kind of what sparked the idea of making this more than just a book. And I had to make it funny, because I like my videos, I feel like the way that we connect, the universal language is laughter. And so even no matter what party you're in, no matter, you know, what color you are, if I can make you laugh, then we can get somewhere. And so in the midst of proximity, in the midst of laughter, in the midst of just telling you about who I am as a Black person, we accomplished a feat, man. I accomplished doing something that I feel is extra special.
What was the most difficult part? And, you know, for folks who will see this, on you know, the YouTube channel. I'm looking down because I've got the book here. So I'm just, as he's talking, I'm just scrolling back through, like, okay, here's my favorite part I want to talk about here. So forgive me when I'm looking down and looking over here where I've got the electronic version of the book on the monitor. I do want to ask you, though, what was the most difficult part about writing this? You've touched on it a little bit, because particularly when you started talking, when you would talk about your relationship with women as a Black man and how that mm-hmm. played itself out, even skirting the gang culture as a young kid, where, like a lot of young Black boys, you're like, dude, I don't want to be a part of a gang, but shit, if I don't, they're going to beat my ass up and they're going to maybe hurt my mama or whatever.
Right, right.
And so you find yourself, but then to sort of, given where you are professionally, to then come back around and sort of put that out there, because people have this image of Tyler Merritt, the author, the comedian, the, you know, mm-hmm. the guy from Netflix. But that's a very real part of that Tyler Merritt story. How difficult was it to write about that in I Take My Coffee Black?
I'll tell you one of the hardest things. I had somebody text me yesterday and said, I can't remember things that happened to me 2 weeks ago, let alone going back to your childhood and you remembering things.
Right.
And there's some things that just stick out. I remember the first time I ever watched a kid get jumped into a gang. And I went to a school with white people, with Mormons, with my Mexican friends and all these different people. And nobody looked at this situation of this Black gang jumping in this Black man the way I did. I looked at it and went, yo, that's a pressure that they don't understand. Like, they're coming for me as well. And not like they're seeking me out, but as a Black man, you feel a pressure to find your people, to find your circle. And right. I went to a middle school that was all gang, it was on Donna Street, which was the main gang in Las Vegas at the time. And that was hard for me to write about because the gang still exists.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I still got to go home to Vegas and see my mom and dad. And, you know, right. some folks going to be like, yo, you that dude that was writing about the Don Street crib? I remember you in sixth grade, fool. You know what I mean? I don't know. But there was that piece, but there was also the probably the hardest part, and I'll be, man, keeping it real, real with you, bro, was talking about how I hurt people throughout my life and how I hurt women and how somebody just recently wrote an article that said, you find yourself in this book by the end wondering if he's the antagonist or the protagonist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, do you even like this dude anymore when you get to the end and realize, like, I've told you that I've hurt people and that, there's a part where I talk about a guy who was in a band with me that I straight up tell you, I stopped talking to him. Still haven't talked to him. Still. And right. I say specifically in the book, if you haven't figured out, if you're looking at me and realizing, oh, this is petty, why haven't you talked to this guy? And I say in the book, I've now given you 12 chapters of telling you of how jacked up I am. And right. if you haven't figured that out yet, you haven't been paying attention, right. you know? So all of that, like, leaving myself out there was hard. And there were moments, man, even when the book was done, Michael, that I was like, shit, I don't know if I, can I wait, can I cuss?
Dude, you clearly haven't listened to this podcast.
I found myself going, man, I may have made a mistake letting people that close in. And that was probably the hardest part, man.
Well, you talk about, you know, the guy you haven't talked to. I love the gentleman, you know, you refer to your relationship with he who shall not be mentioned.
Yeah. So
if you want to get a sense of how he comes at the storylines and of his life, that should give you an indication right now that he's writing about something that would happen when he was in high school. And he's referring to this guy's he who shall not be mentioned.
Yeah. Like, and I say straight up, like, I ain't going to mention his name in this book. So, but it's important that you know who he is.
Right.
So, well, and I say, we'll call him Voldemort, but here's the truth, man. here's the truth, man. Looking back now, so many of these stories that hurt me so bad as a kid or like when I was in college, you know, they're in the past. We, you know, these people have moved on and I have moved on and all of that. But when you recall the actual story, you remember how hurt you were. And you also remember how that transfer, like how that switched your life and how that those singular moments affected you. I talk about, there's a whole section where I talk about your black card, where I say, hey, I might lose my black card right now because I'm about to go in extra hard on Gwyneth Paltrow.
Right.
And so, and I go and talk about Gwyneth, and I basically say there's this movie she did called Sliding Doors, where if she would have went one direction, she would have went this way, or the other direction, she would have went the other way. And there were so many sliding door moments in my life where one single incident changed the whole projection of my life, you know? And I feel like we all have those stories, but rarely do we get together and talk about it.
Well, that was especially true for you in your discovery of faith, and how you resisted Christian camp. Your mom was like, oh, that'd be a good idea. You're like, hell to the no.
No,
we're not. Mom, I'm not. No.
And my mom got me. My mom said, you do realize that there's going to be girls there. Yes. And I went, oh, shit.
Okay.
And I was thinking, Michael, and Christian boys aren't cool. Like, I'm going to be a pimp in this environment. I'm going to show up at this church camp and be like, what up?
Right.
And, you know.
Well, but that's interesting because you see these sort of diametrically opposing views of self, where on the one hand, you did. Well, you were in high school when you, particularly when you had to transfer to the theater school, to the to the newly opened theater school. And you're like, I'm a big pimp. What the hell? I'm going up with all these sort of, what am I going to? Your mom is like, oh, no, this is going to be good for your education. We've all had that conversation, right? And you're like, but you're messing up my pimp groove. You know, I'm working with the ladies over here. But then you have a realization about theater kids. You're like, oh, okay. I'm going to be the big dog on that block. The same opened up when you had Christian camp put in front of you. And you're like, oh, I can go game the system. But the underlying story, which is what I love about the authenticity of your telling it, was how you realized you got changed. Those moments changed you. All of a sudden, you realized, oh, this theater stuff is a part of actually who I am. I'm not the big pimp. Right. I'm actually this kid who's pretty damn good at playing a role on a stage and can sing a song. Oh, I'm not here at Christian camp trying to pick up a date every night. I actually have this little thing called faith. What was that journey like for you? How was that? Well, not the journey so much the discovery of it.
I'll tell you, especially camp, man. And I talk about it really in detail in the book, man. I remember showing up to camp the very first day, Michael, and being like, all these honeys are here, you know.
Folks, this is Christian camp, okay? So this is, just so you know where he's coming from.
Yeah, this wasn't like theater camp, this wasn't sports, this was Christian camp. And I showed up like, honeys, let's go. And the first night we had chapel, man, and I was in there and I talk about it with, I had this heavy triple fat goose jacket on trying to be cool in a summer camp in Las Vegas. Burning up hot, but I looked cool. And by the end of this singular service, man, like, God got a hold of me. Like, he got a hold of me. And I talk about the Bible. I talk about thin places in the book where there's these moments in time that you can't explain what's happening. And in that singular service, it was so powerful, Michael, that I left that night. And some people after the service we walked back to the cabin and they came to me and were like, yo, you want to walk back together? Even some girls were like, hey, Tyler. And I said to them, no, I need to walk back to my cabin by myself. Cause I walked out of that chapel, and the air felt different. The stars looked bright. Like something happened to me in that singular moment. And it's so funny because I talk about it throughout the book, how so many of these moments led into me falling into my trick of wanting to be around girls, and that singular thing about wanting to be around girls turns into something else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that sliding door moment of that summer camp, I talk about in the book where I say, man, I say, I knew walking back to my cabin that I was going to be changed forever. Like I was going to be changed for the rest of my life. And when you get to the very end of the book, I say, I remember that night, and it really did change me. It didn't make me perfect by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, the very next chapter is called I'm Supposed to Do What, where it's me dealing with how to be a Jesus-y Black kid going back into this world now as a Jesus-y Black kid, you know?
Well, but that was the interesting thing about the narrative was how this young kid is conflicted in more ways than the typical growing up, right? You know, yeah, hanging with my boys, you know, discovering girls and all of that. But then you had all these other elements that sort of draw out of you really who you are and who you're likely to be. And I was particularly struck, you know, talking about the faith journey. You say one thing that was a particular thorn in my Black side was the youth pastor, who we will call Pastor Scott. You know, every Sunday he'd see me and invite me to come to the youth group. I had no interest in that. And your mom was like, oh, yeah, go on, baby. That'd be a good thing. You're like, Mom, I am too cool for youth camp, let alone all this other stuff. Right. But at the end of the day, you find yourself having to confront it anyway.
Right,
because you have to confront yourself, because there was something inside of you that was drawn to that. I, you know, when I say to folks, when I talk about, I take, you know, my coffee Black and I talk about your story and I say, there's so many parallels. I grew up in Washington, D.C., unexposed to a lot of things that would later, as that sliding door changed my life going through the door, you know, where I was suddenly exposed, you know, this kid growing up in the inner city of D.C. to theater, right? And finding out, oh, snap, I like this. And Glee Club, you know, singing, you know, all male chorus. You mean boys sing too? I thought, oh, okay. That's cool. We're having a wonderful conversation with my buddy, Tyler Merritt, the author of the new book, I Take My Coffee Black. When we come back, we'll have more fun. We'll be right back.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I just hope you're having the podcast of your life right now, because I know I am. This is so much fun talking to Tyler Merritt, the author of the new book, out right now, I Take My Coffee Black. And in it, it is the discovery of a young kid, the adventures of a young man, and the musings of a gentleman who's lived and is living life as a Black man. You know, all of these little stories where I saw myself, Even with the honeys, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I had no game. When I say no game, I was this 6-foot lanky ass bush wearing out to Northeast DC kind of brother. And my bush had a part down the side. So you know
I need you to text me some pictures of old school Michael Steele.
You know, I was a messed up brother with all kinds of image and self-esteem issues. But where I thought I was cool was when it came to talking to the ladies. I had no game. I mean, and my game was so bad that girls, when they looked at me, it was like, yeah, he can make an okay friend.
Right. You were that guy.
I was that guy, right? You know, guys harassing them. I'm the brother over there. Leave her alone. What you gonna do about it? Nothing. But you know, it's just so there were so many parallels that I could see. And I think people, when they read this story, you know, you have chapters like "Forget You, Brad Pitt, and Your Sexy Ass Hair." You know, yeah, forget you, and you realize, well, the story isn't so much about Brad Pitt, but about all the shit that goes into thinking you should be Brad Pitt,
right,
or try to be Brad Pitt. How do you find discovery in that as a young kid, but then looking back on it as an adult and go, yeah, that was messed up, but you know what? I'm even more messed up now.
I remember specifically in that chapter, man, I remember being in a movie with a girl, and I joke, well, I'll tell you what's really funny is that chapter for a good 4 weeks was called "Fuck You, Brad Pitt" is what it was called. And I decided to only drop the F word one time in each chapter, and it would have been twice in that chapter. And so I pulled it and just changed it to "Forget You, Brad Pitt." But I took a girl to the movies, and I'm sitting here all obsessed with this girl, realizing I had made the biggest mistake taking her to a Brad Pitt movie, because you can't compete against movie size Brad Pitt. Oh. And I'm in the movie, Mike, I'm in the movie looking at her while we're watching Legend of the Fall. Like, yeah, look at what I've done. And she turns to me at one point and goes, "He is so gorgeous." I'm like, what the hell? And so I joke about there. F you, Brad Pitt. Don't ever take your lady to a Brad Pitt movie. But
no, it's like taking them to go hang out with Denzel Washington. No,
don't. And these were things that I learned. But to answer your question, man, I think we, especially at a certain age, and some of us carry this on into our adulthood, we try so hard to find our worth in other people.
Yeah.
We try so hard to fill all of our insecurities based on what someone else says about who we are and what it is that we do. And I had been hurt so bad by women, even at that point, the F you Brad Pitt section, that I spent the next 20 years of my life trying to protect my heart and hurting women back and being evil sometimes, man. Until I will say this, you get to a point somewhere in your life, man, we're going to be slapped across the face with reality, and you get put into a place that makes you a better person. And it took me a long time to get there, man, but I'm slowly on that path now. But I spent so many years just trying to protect my heart with no respect for women, with no respect for other men, all in the midst of being a Black dude walking through this shit.
I know.
You know what I'm saying?
I know.
Like, you talked about Glee Club and musical theater and all of that, man. Something I don't think people get, and I'm going to just jump into this part, because I think you and I, we get this. Somebody said to me, is this book for Black people or just specifically for, you know, white people to understand? I said, no, this is I get more of a reaction from my Black friends from this book than I do anybody, because rarely do we get to read material that is screaming to people that we are not just one thing.
Thank you. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And what's so hard about that is people don't have understand the struggle that we even have amongst other Black folk who may have only lived a life of one thing and then see us living a life, and, you know, we don't fall into the stereotypical things that Black people should do. When I decide I want to do theater and not play basketball, when I decide that I want to go to a church that has multicultural people in it and not to the Black church, when I decide that I like the band Counting Crows and Dr. Dre, you know, we fall into this thing where there's an expectancy of us as Black people to be the way Black people are perceived. And people don't understand the thing that we kind of fight against of sometimes feeling like, who do we have to prove that we're Black enough to? Because our own personal experiences have led us in different journeys. Man, I had the New York Times write an article about me. They didn't get a lot of attention from it because it was in their magazine.
Right.
But they basically wrote an article, bro, that said, after Before You Call the Cops came out, it said, we need to stop judging Black people by their whiteness. which was basically saying that before you call the cops, I was saying things that were white. Therefore, white people could relate to me by saying, I like Oklahoma. I'm like, no, bitch, I'm just a black dude that likes musicals. Like, I'm a black dude that likes musicals. I'm a black dude who likes Bon Jovi. Like, fuck you. Right. You know, like, we don't have to be one thing. And yeah, that's kind of something that I scream in this book, that we're not.
Oh, you don't, you don't just scream it. You take it, and on each page, America, on each page, this brother nails it to your forehead for you to understand that black people, and I'll just put it out there, not going to anybody else, but of all the people, the most multidimensional black folks, because we had to be. We had to be, right?
Right.
We could never afford to be just one thing.
Right.
So as white folks were creating this stereotype, they didn't even understand how wrong they were in that own, in their own creation, because they knew, they pulled out one thing of many things to focus right on. And so that multidimensional character of the black community is what I think is almost the subtitle of this book, because it gets into, I'm a black kid from Vegas, right? Who everyone thinks should be in the thug gang life because of the neighborhood I grew up in, the high school or the grade school, elementary mm-hmm. school I go to. But dude, I like Bon Jovi. I like theater. I like music. I like this. I like that. I'm this type of person. I have black friends. I have Hispanic friends. And it's that multidimensional nature that I think is so endearing in this book. And I'm sure you never thought a black man would refer to anything you wrote as endearing. But again, we are multidimensional,
right?
And we can say words like endearing, and people not sit there and go, "Well, that was an awfully white thing to say." but that's how it is. And here's the stick: we run into that, Tyler, in our own community. You touch on, you know, the fact I got a white girlfriend. I don't know what the sister's gonna think about that. Why? Because right. We have to be sensitive to that. We also know that even within our own community, we sometimes fall into those traps that are set by others in their description, their narrative of black men, black women, the black community as a whole. And you try to tear down some of those stereotypes. You try to break through some of those narratives to expose that at the end of the day, no matter what I do, no matter how I do it, where I do it, who I do it with, I'm still a black man.
Right. I still walk out the door as a black man. Something that I purposely did in this book, and I don't think I've ever been able to explain it the way I'm going to explain it to you right now, is publicly, is I open the book with the chapter, If She Only Knew Me, where I talk about walking through and this white woman sees me.
Yes.
But what I do is I drop some hints as to who I am, right?
Where can I set you up yeah. on that? Because I was this is why I'm saying you and I are kismet, brother, because I was just about to read that portion of the book. I've got it right here on my screen.
Go ahead.
So to help you set up your point. So in the opening, If She Only Knew, quote, and there, on the other side of the street, parked at the curb right in front of the crosswalk, was an older white woman in a blue and white older model Ford truck. She had her driver's side window down, which meant that I would be passing by her open window, and at some point, I would be less than a few feet away from her. And I knew in that instant, because, well, life. When you live in the South, and you're 6'2" and black with dreadlocks, you know how some people perceive you. I have had a lifetime of white women reacting to me in fear, not because of my size or because of my clothing, but because of my blackness. But let me be clear. I have also had a lot of white women react to me because of the complete and utter magnitude of my sexiness. Okay, so we'll leave that last part for a later discussion. But that in essence is how you set up If She Only Knew. And you go on and you say, I decided at the moment, like I do in most moments, that I was going to do everything I possibly could to keep an old white lady from freaking out. That is the story of Black America. How do we keep white folks from freaking out when we walk into the boardroom on Wall Street, when we walk into the Walmart and want to go, have our kids go in the aisle where the guns are and play with them like every other white kid who's in the Walmart? Mm-hmm. How we keep white folks from freaking out, when we walk down the street and our arms are loaded with our own packages, and yet they still see us as a threat.
Right, right, right. And I talk about it in that chapter, man. I let me just say this, man. I love you so much, Michael Still. Like, I just feel like we're so kindred, man. It makes my heart smile, for real. But there's in that chapter, I go into the depth of why do I have to make myself less, and right. I talk about, I give hints and I drop hints in that first chapter where I say, I'm on this walk and I have my Alabama hoodie on. I put my headphones on and I'm listening to music. And I give all these hints in this first chapter about who I am. And I don't give it to you specifically, but I hint that I'm listening to this Broadway musical. And I say all of these things in this very first chapter.
Right.
That are just really weird, right? Like, you're kind of going, whoa, this guy's giving me a lot of information about who he is. And then I have this experience with this white woman. And then I end the chapter by saying, lady, if you only knew me, if you knew that, because I say I took down my scarf, my head wrap so she could see my head. I took off my glasses so she could see my eyes. I took off my headphones so she could hear me, took down my hoodie. And then I walked by with a smile, looking like a Black Mr. Rogers, just saying to her, please, please, please don't be afraid. She still was. And I do all of these things. And at the end of that chapter, I say, if you knew me, if you actually knew me, if you knew that I just pulled off my headphones and stopped listening to Bring It On, the musical, a musical about cheerleaders, if you knew that that's what was happening in my headphones,
yep.
If you knew who I was, then you would not be afraid of me. And so I give all this information in that first chapter, and then I spend the next 16 chapters explaining why I'm listening to a Broadway musical, why I have an Alabama hoodie on. I introduce all that stuff in that first chapter, and then I let the reader go through why I'm that guy in that first chapter. So then when I bring them back to the last chapter, which is If She Only Knew Chapter 2, and I remind you of what we walked through at the very first chapter, now as the reader are going, this all makes sense. Of course he has an Alabama hoodie on. Of course he's listening to Bring It On, the musical.
Right.
He's doing all these things. And now you know why. So now when you get to the end of the book and I say to you again, if she would have only knew me, you too, as a reader, are screaming, hell yeah, if you knew this dude, you would love him. And then I say in there, and this is kind of the crux of that little part, is at the end of the book, I say, if you knew who I was, you would have jumped out of your car and came to me and said, Tyler, you beautiful Black man, you are a king. And I would have said, you know what? The reason why I made myself less is because that's some king shit. That's what kings do.
That's what kings do. Damn. Well, that does it for our conversation together today. And as you can see, I'm whipped. I'm gonna go lie down now because I'm spent. But I'll be back. I'll be back next time. And when I do, you know what we're going to get. We're going to take it real and keep it real. Appreciate everybody out there doing that download thing. When you give me a little 5-star on the podcast rating. We love that too. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. You can follow my brother, Tyler Merritt. What's your Twitter handle, bro?
At TTM Project, and on Instagram at Tyler Merritt Project.
There you go. Look for the book, I Take My Coffee Black. If you want to get a feel of what you're about to get into, check out those viral videos, Before You Call the Cops and Walking While Black. Gives you a little bit of further appreciation of where my brother Tyler Merritt's coming from. So until next time, be safe, be well. You know what I'm going to say. Get the damn vaccine, right? No shit. Stop pretending.
Yes.
And wear the mask. All right. So we can get past this shit and move on to healthier, better days. All right. I'm out. Later.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.